call the meeting to order. The Game and Fish Committee, the first item is the February 8th minutes. Representative Cornish, you reviewed the minutes?
Yes.
Representative Cornish moves to approve the February 8th minutes of the Game, Fish, and Forestry Division. Any questions on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, first, we are going to discuss possible regulation changes and general discussion on trapping regulations. We have with us four or five folks from the Minnesota Trappers Association and the various districts. And so we'll start out with Sean Johnson from the Minnesota Trappers Association. May I come forward? See here? Yeah, right there.
Proper protocol here.
Yeah, you come right up there in the front. Welcome. If you'll state your name for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Sean Johnson. I represent the Minnesota Trappers Association as president. Where do you want to start here, folks? You're going to have to walk me through this. The Minnesota Trappers Association has an annual convention whereby the general membership votes on a series of initiatives that are brought forth from the board of directors or from the districts to the board of directors and back to the membership to vote on. There were four this last turn around. I don't know if you all have copies of these. I know Representative Dill has got a copy of this in my correspondence with him. These are the four initiatives. I can certainly get you another copy if you need. But at any rate, the four that were put forth were, I got them in different order here, but that there was a separate synopsis put together for the trapping issues alone. The current regulations book has approximately 6 pages that deal with trapping. It was felt by the membership that due to the complexity of many of the laws that have been recently enforced, various interpretations with conservation officers, etc., that there could be some clarifications made in the laws, in the law book for the layman. Like I said, just clarifications on a lot of the laws. That 6 pages were inadequate to address the large amount of gray areas, so to speak. Along with that, there's asked, we asked, and initially went to DNR with these proposals to begin with to try to work out some kind of a compromise on conservation contact information. Very difficult to get a hold of in the field. Trapping, unlike a lot of other outdoor sports, brings you within the jurisdiction of several different conservation officers. And we have the way the seasons are set up predominantly with spring beaver trapping. Otters are a common incidental take to beaver trapping, same habitats, same type of trapping techniques. Otter season is closed prior to the spring beaver season. Animals are taken after the season, such as otter, and they're a special limit species, so there's additional considerations there as well. But you have to receive transportation authorization from a conservation officer to take that animal and to transport it. The problem being you don't know who the conservation officer is in that particular area. You need to get a verbal confirmation to move it. Otherwise, the animal has to stay at the trap site. And you wait until you get a hold of someone later on. There's an issue of animals being wasted if they spoil before a conservation officer gets back to you. The MTA has been working through it with the DNR on several of these issues, trying to resolve the way that's put together. The association voted to simply extend the season to run together with otter, muskrat, and beaver to run concurrently. And any incidentals would no longer be incidentals. So if you take otter or muskrats during a cold season, if you straighten the seasons out, then it wouldn't be an issue. There was some consideration as to wanton waste was a big thing. So, game warden contact information, the run otter, beaver, and muskrat season concurrently. Let's see, where's the third here? Conservation officer contact, otter, and regulations clarification, yep. And then less than 5 years ago now, the Trappers Association, along with some hunting groups, The DNR dropped a closed season on Fox and Raccoon for a period of time. So there were no closed seasons. They could be taken 12 months a year. The association felt that this is a waste of a renewable resource, and they're taken out of their prime, and it led to abuses of our resources. And with the Coon Hunters Association and various other groups, we petitioned the DNR to reinstate a closed season for litter rearing times and such for the animals. Everyone was united on that end that we wanted a closed season. However, it came down to when exactly we draw that line. The proposal now, from the at least in the northern portions of Minnesota, was to open the raccoon and fox season on the Saturday closest to October 15th, but not before the 15th. And the issues of climate and accessibility, opportunity before the big freeze and such. So, was just another related problem to this is folks that want to go out and trap coyotes, which are non-protected. Should you catch a fox or a raccoon, they're not legal. You have to get a hold of a conservation officer right back in the same ball game again there. So it was looking to eliminate a lot of that confusion. Conservation officer contact, separate synopsis or clarifications of the laws and the trapping regulations, opening the raccoon and fox season on the 15th, but not before the 15th, October in the forest zone, and running otter, muskrat, and beaver seasons concurrently were the four on the itinerary. And as I attempted to state earlier, I don't know how well I did with it, we are working with the DNR on coming to some kind of a compromise on the otter situation. That's yet to be determined yet on how that's going to work out. But we wanted the representative deal to be aware of what was going on with that. The conservation officer contact information, it looks like they're coming together with a mapping system with the dispatchers and such, so that's going to be taken care of. So that's about where we're at right now, folks, as far as the MTA is concerned. Mr. Christensen, you care to add anything to that?
I would answer any questions.
Will you come up to the microphone, please? You can stay there in case we got any questions for you.
Sure.
Identify yourself for the tape and go ahead.
My name is Con Christensen. I'm here with the Minnesota Trappers Association. I'm here to answer any questions. Sean has pretty well covered the waterfront. I would reemphasize that we have worked with the DNR in the last few months and have come to partial resolution on some of these things. The conservation officer contact information, I believe, will be put on maps, which will be distributed to people on a need basis. That should take care of most of the problems with people not knowing how to get a hold of a CO if they're trapping in an area they're not, where they don't know all the law enforcement people or their particular lines, work areas, and that kind of thing. But I think these questions can be resolved through changes in a rule. It should not necessitate a change in law. And we just want to be able to work with the DNR on these things and have you know that we're doing that. So if there are any questions.
Questions to the committee. Representative Salem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be for either of the testifiers. But I was just looking at the point number four about unfortunately trappers learn most of their regulation or the rules in the courtroom. And I would just, I know it's always difficult to get information out to people. Could you just elaborate a little bit on what the Trappers Association does or plans to do to make sure that, you know, how do you get the information out to those people that aren't in the choir, so to speak, you know, that aren't part of the group that always talk back and forth? How can you get that information out to some of the trappers that maybe aren't as involved as you folks?
One of you two gentlemen like to answer that?
Representative and committee members, I'm sorry I can't see your sign. Anyway, the Trappers Association, in cooperation with the state, has the Trapper Education Program, and I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but any trapper now coming on online who has not had a license previously has to go through a course. It's a field course and a study course, and there's a test and so on. So a lot of that information will get out then. We have a website, which is also quite good. We have a newsletter that's very good. I don't know what we can do beyond our membership once the new trapper goes through the orientation or the mandatory training. If they're not members, they don't get newsletters. They might or might not visit the website. But yes, those are our options for disseminating information. That answer your question, ma'am?
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair. Yes, you know, and I guess I happen to think of a number of trappers that I know that wouldn't touch a website for anything on earth. And so I'm thinking you could put a lot of information out there and it wouldn't really do them a whole lot of good. So I was just curious about what sorts of things you're doing for those that aren't going through the training program, some trappers that have been out there for a long time, you know, and just helping them to, you know, get in touch with any of the new regulations. I know that's always a challenge. I just wondered how you were going to approach that.
Yes, it is a challenge. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Tal.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, how many trappers are out there? I know that you have an association, but annually, how many people trap?
Do you the DNR annually sells around 6,000 resident trapping license a year.
Any further questions of the testifiers?
Excuse me.
Before you guys leave, could Mr. Bogus, can you come down? Go ahead. Did you have something you wanted to add?
I was just going to note that about half those people that trap are members.
So can one of you make room for Mr. Bogus? He'll pull a chair over. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Their item number four, allow, says allow the DNR to offer a separate synopsis. Well, my recollection is we don't either encourage nor discourage the department to print a synopsis or rule book or anything like that, that's an administrative function that the department decides how to implement. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, and for the record, Ed Bogus, Department of Natural Resources, there's a statute that requires that we produce a summary of the hunting and trapping laws and make it available, but that's the extent to which it goes. We've had various methods of doing that over the years. Prior to the mid-90s, we had little pamphlets for about everything, and then the decision was made to consolidate those into a one handbook, which we did. We've since produced a supplement for waterfowl because the federal regulations come out late, but there's nothing in statute that constrains the department in how it summarizes those laws and rules.
And so if their claim is there's 128 pages in the hunting and trapping regulations and only six devoted to trapping regulations, I'm going to have to sit down and figure out how many more pages are needed to get you there. And I'd like to hear from both the Trappers Association and you if you, you know, how much more is needed, what would be the cost if they had a separate panel. What is the cost to print the or could you provide the committee with the cost to print the waterfowl supplement?
Mr. Chair, I used to be in charge of printing those, but it's been quite a few years. I've lost track of what it costs. For the handbook itself, it used to be in the range of $150,000. I think the waterfowl supplement's probably around $10,000 or $20,000, but I'd have to get you those exact figures. I can get back to you on that. And just to your question, Mr. Chair, As representatives of the Trappers Association have indicated, we've been meeting with them, and we have another meeting scheduled in a few weeks. And we try, in the regulations booklet that we print for the hunters and trappers, we try to summarize all, not only the statutes, but the rules and any federal rules that they need to know. So we're working on what they think is missing in there so that we can add that in, and we're expecting to have some more discussion on what may be missing, and we will work with them to either add pages, or if we print a separate booklet, there's a lot of duplicated information because the trappers generally need to follow the small game regulations, and so you know, there's a lot of things, trespass laws and general hunting laws and things like that, that need to be duplicated in each book. So we're sitting down with them and discussing what seems to be missing in there and trying to figure out a way to make sure that it's covered, because the whole intent of those regulations is to provide enough information that people don't inadvertently violate the law.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things, Mr. Bogus or Mr. Johnson. I'm just curious about the you guys mentioned the thought about having the CO's name, phone number, area, you know, email address or whatever potentially in the handbook. And I know I've seen it in some other states. They do that. So I'm curious both to hear both of your thoughts on that, and I guess if Representative Cornish was willing to weigh in, what the thoughts would be about putting that in the book. As far as the CO's name and phone number and stuff.
Representative Cornish.
They've gone around it, or Mr. Chair and the committee, they've gone around for years and years about contacting COs and what's the best way, and they dispatch, I think, still through the, depends on the CO, but through the patrol dispatch, and they are hard to get a hold of, and when you have to notify somebody about a something at this site, it is a problem, and we've struggled with it for years. So I don't know what the best way is. It's going to make for a volume of calls to the COs, but it they thought about, some of them put their, it's kind of an option, some of them put their names in, some don't. There is some directories that have them listed up front with the patrol, but it's such a helter-skelter. Maybe the enforcement person there could answer that.
Welcome. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Major Rodman Smith, DNR Operations Manager for the Division of Enforcement. Mr. Chair, members, some of the ideas we have for increasing our availability for folks is this mapping system that would be available on the website, so an individual trapper could zoom into their area and then it would show the different conservation officer areas in the area that they trap. And one thing we're looking at is to have a tear-off page in the synopsis itself so that the trapper or hunter, whoever would want to look up that area, could write down the conservation officer's name and contact number. And the reason we're not going to put it in the synopsis is because those numbers will change. And I know in other states, I've talked to some of my counterparts in other states, that some people get upset when they're trying to get a hold of a number. Well, your number's in the book, and you're not answering your phone. Well, it's changed. So the website would have the up-to-date numbers for the conservation officer. So then when somebody went afield, they, before season, they could look, see the area that they're going to be trapping, be able to write down the conservation officer's contact information and tear it out of the book and bring it with them if they want to, or they could leave it in the book and bring the book with them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Major Smith, what about, do you know currently if we go online, is it relatively easy? And I got to say, I haven't done it, but say I was in the field, how easy is it to find the local CO and either send them an email, or is there a phone number where we potentially could call them if we had an issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the contact information is easy to get to and it's easy to find. The problem is the maps that are on there, our lines do not follow county lines. Sometimes they'll follow a county road then into a township road or cut cross country sometimes. So unless you know that Officer X is your conservation officer, you might not know exactly and the technology is there now so that we could make that easier, more user-friendly, so you could pinpoint your cabin, for example, and then you would know exactly who your conservation officer was. And we're currently working with DNR staff to get that completed. Our goal is to have the website or link printed in the synopsis this year and have it up and running by fall. So,
well, I have a question. If you called the tips line and told them what your location was, could the tips line tell you who the CO is?
Mr. Chair, it depends on who answers the tip line. During the weekday, it is answered by DNR staff, and then in the evenings and sometimes on the weekends, it is answered by State Patrol dispatch, and it depends on the dispatcher's capabilities and call load that they have at that time to look through the map. And quite honestly, some people that they know where they live, but they can't explain to somebody else where they live when they're looking at a map.
Could you walk through the committee through the process that a trapper would have to take if he had an incidental take of an otter or a muskrat?
Mr. Chair, members, they're basically, those are two separate, what I like to call classifications of animals. In rule, if there's an incidentally taken animal, if it's a fisher, marten, otter, or fox, bobcat, those animals cannot be removed from the site unless you've contacted a conservation officer. Now, you can take it out of the trap, hang it in a tree, and then get back and call a conservation officer. A muskrat, for example, you could take that from the site where it was incidentally taken, but then you have a certain amount of time to call the conservation officer and notify him that you had that incidental critter and that you took it from the trap. And those are contained in rule. Mr. Chair, one of the things we talked about with the Trappers Association was to, in the synopsis, more clearly state step by step what somebody would do if they did have an incidental take. It's not as clear as it could be. We realize that now once it's been brought to our attention. So one thing we're working on is if you catch these types of critters, let's say it's an otter or whatnot, these are the steps you need to take. And if you catch a different type of critter, muskrat, for example, these are the steps you take.
And what happens to the animal when they contact the CO and the CO comes out to the site and the fox is hanging, or the otter is hanging in a tree, and what happens to the otter?
Mr. Chair, that normally would be then taken, we'd write out a seizure slip or confiscation slip, basically, meaning that we're taking that animal into state custody, and then that animal would be brought back, and sometimes the trapper would skin it, and they'd get a pelting fee for it, and then the state would then take our pelts and then sell them at auction, and then that money goes back, I believe, into the Game and Fish Fund.
Mr. Chair, and that's another one that's gone back and forth over the years too. It's really hard to figure because sometimes it's a shame what the otter and the fisher are going for. It's a few bucks, and other times a fisher or otter, like a fisher, up to $150. And so what they worry about is somebody catching one on purpose and saying it's incidental, and then coming out of the woods and then having the CO be put on the spot to see if they're bringing out of the woods to him, like a lot of them say, oh, I'm just going to bring this one to you. And so that's why they had to leave it at the site. And it's, you know, you don't want to make the trapper out to be a bad guy or the CO to be a chiseler on the tickets. So this system was thought up, and it's really a tough one to balance against the trapper. It's a lot of hassle for the trapper to have to leave an animal there, especially if you're not coming back and you're way back in the woods. So have you made any progress on that? And what's the pelting fee now? It used to be, it was all over the range from half to one-fourth of what the trapper gets out of the actual sale of the pelt. No.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, what we've done is it's half of the cost of the pelt at sale, or it's capped at $25 now. So the most the person could get for the pelting fee is $25.
So I can see that that could be a a financial disincentive for the trapper. I mean, if you're out on the 200 road off the Echo Trail and the, and you can't get a hold of the CO and you live in Cook, you might as well just leave the animal, just forget it, throw it in the bush. Because, I mean, you're going to spend $100 driving to and from for a maximum of $25 on an animal that might only be worth $20 to start with. I mean, I'm not saying that the trapper would do that, but there sure isn't a financial incentive to be a good steward of the resource. I don't know, something to think about as we move forward. And be absolutely honest with you, I would hope that you guys could work this out before we put a bill together. Because I think that you guys could figure this out better than the legislature can. But some of these things just seem a little bit problematic. That one seems to be maybe hard to make work from both sides. I'm not saying one side or the other. I'm just trying to see both sides of this. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, another note. What kind of progress are you making on this split season? Used to be it opened to different stages, one for the south, one for the north. The north trappers hated it because if it opened in the north and not in the south yet, then the southern trappers would all come up and you'd be overcrowding in the north. There was a jealousy and turf battles. But if you didn't open it at the right time or have a split season, then they would worry about the furs being very unprime, you know. Is it a big concern whether they're prime or not? Is that a big concern to the DNR now, or is it kind of like wild rice? Just open it up, and if somebody's going to buy it, let them buy it if it's green. Kind of like, could you do the same with that with hides and just open it all at once? Or what kind of progress you made with the Trappers Association?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, it's always been a contentious issue because the seasons either are a little too late for the northern part of the state or a little too early for the southern part of the state, and it is a long state north and south, and so and the primeness and freeze up varies dramatically from northern Minnesota to southern Minnesota. So quite a few years ago now, we developed a formula that kind of alternated whether we had split openers for the water trapping season, so that there were certain dates, and working with the Trappers Association, at least at that time, there were certain dates where they felt like if it was like the 26th, 27th of October, that wasn't so bad, but if it got to be into early November, that was pretty late for the north because things were frozen up. If it got to be much earlier than that, it was too early in the south. And so we developed a formula that results in, and I can't remember exactly how it works, but roughly half of the time we split, and the other half when it's not on those sort of common dates that seem to work pretty well statewide, we split the state. If it is on those common, if the last Saturday in October falls on those common dates, then we open the state statewide. So I guess the answer to your question is we're doing a little bit of both still in terms of alternating that, because It's been highly contentious when we don't split, and this balance of splitting some years and not others has seemed to work about as well as anything that we've come up with.
Any other questions? You gentlemen have anything more you'd like to add?
Just thank you for your time.
Oh, yep, we're going to work on some of these issues this year. So now we've got Ray Sogard and Russ Sikla come up. And Ken, do you want to come up too at the same time? Okay. So the first time each of you addresses, could you give your name and who you represent? Then we'll be good to go.
All right. I'd like to talk first. But my name is Ken Winnepaw. I'm a member of the Minnesota Trappers Association, District 1. If you look in your books, you can see we have a map in there showing the 8 districts in Minnesota. All right. So I represent District 1 of the Minnesota Trappers. To go back up a little bit, the question that Ms. Saylor had on who non-members of the MTA, how could they get information? That's why we need this complete trapping synopsis. At the time of license purchase, the books are available at wherever the, you know, where they purchase. And if we had that book available right there, you know, we do have them, but a better book, the more complete book, then non-members of the MTA would have this complete information on trapping. That's why we push for a really good book. And like you mentioned, Chairman, on how many pages, that has to be thought out pretty carefully. We don't know. You know, there's lots of laws. And then back up to the incidental take, Chairman Dill. Not everybody has access to a computer or a website to find these phone numbers that, you know, the DNR said. What would work is a central dispatch number, like they mentioned, the highway patrol number. This number, if it changed, it could be published in the local newspapers. Because people, all people don't have computers, you know, even though we're modern. There's a lot of people without computers. But if this number to call for DNR help or COs was in a local paper, you know, that, it's pretty easy to do that. That way, these people would have a phone number. Of course, like you mentioned, at the end of 200 Road or in Lake County on the end of Pine Lake Road, you know, there's no phone service. And, you know, my trap line runs about 150 miles one way, and the phones don't work. So if it's an incidental take, they're, I don't know, it's tough to drive all the way back or drive 100 miles to get phone service. I don't know. I don't know the answer. So it is a problem. It is a problem. Now, what else can I answer here? Those are the two things I had to get out.
Okay, well, we'll just keep going for the time being. Go ahead.
My name is Ray Sogard. I'm District 1 Director for the Minnesota Trappers Association. And you received a summary today with regard to the issues involved. And as a direct result of Ken's efforts, we have 6 more issues that we certainly would like addressed. Before I think we get to that, I think the statements on incidental take are a very tough issue, but our problems are that we need time. If we have an incidental take, we need time to get a hold of the DNR, and we have to work with the DNR, and there has to be a certain level of trust here. Because, believe me, all trappers are not lawbreakers like they were 20 years ago. Most of us are recreational trappers. I myself work 8 hours a day. I have 3.5 hours to trap after work. That's it. And on weekends. So we're not the bad guys that we're made out to be sometimes. We need a little level of trust between ourselves and the DNR. Hanging an animal in the woods, if it's an incidental take and the last day of season and we can't get a hold of anybody, makes absolutely no sense for anybody. And we have to address that issue. Preferably with Ken's group, we'd like to see this in the form of a law instead of a rule, because we don't want to keep addressing it time after time. But That's a preference. So getting along to the other things that, Ken's group would like to see, is they would like a three-day check on snares in the forest zone only. And the forest zone is described in, on page 47 of the synopsis. The DNR is very prone to zones because you have the forest zone, you have the northern mink, muskrat, beaver, and otter zone, and the southern mink, muskrat, beaver, otter zone. You have the Fisher, Martin, and Bobcat zone. So zoning of the state is not a new issue with regard to the DNR. We're very concerned with that very much affects us is the forest zone. And so in the forest zone, on three-day check on snares, excluding the lynx zone, which is another zone that was developed through the process of the Federal Fish and Wildlife due to the lynx case, if we exclude all that, we would like a three-day check on snares. Mainly, the rationale for this is the forest zone has very dense cover. Climate is often severe at times, and which leads to transportation and compliance problems for the trapper. Allowing the snare to be used would help us in that regard, mainly because the snare in itself is an effective tool to taking fur bearers, and it's every bit as deadly as a body gripping trap, and it's just about as fast, probably the second if you rank them, conibear type snares and then foothold trap. So we would like to see this addressed, hopefully in the form of a law. Number two is one slight change that we have is to allow the fall water trapping season to begin the third Saturday in October in the forest zone only. The rationale with this, again, is climate. What happens, especially in the northern zone, the way it's set now, more often than not, we have about 3 to 5 days to trap mink and water animals before freeze-up. And that I don't think that that was the intention of this body, nor the DNR, and I think with the establishment of the zones, I think they meant to change it, but they haven't taken the extra step to do so, and we would like this clarified and virtually addressed. So at least in the forest zone, we could get actual, ideally would be 2 weeks of trapping water animals. That unfortunately it is not the case right now. Number three is to allow the creation of a separate identification for taxidermy. The way the law states now is the animals cannot be brought in to be tagged if they're on the carcass. The hide has to be taken off the carcass. Well, the problem is if it's a beautiful animal and you want it mounted, you can't. And the problem is the taxidermists themselves want to skin the animal themselves, so they do a good job. And so as trappers, if we get pressure from the taxidermist, we want to save this beautiful animal for posterity, and the DNR won't allow us to tag it. This should be a very simple issue, is to just allow a tag or some kind of verification to allow us to bring it to the taxidermist to have the animal done by them in order to get the animal mounted. We really don't think that this should be a problem. Number four is somewhat different. We believe, or Ken's group believes, that this would be a better option in creating a special synopsis. Right now, trappers must have two licenses. They have a trapping license, they have a small game license. We believe if you take the small game portion of this booklet, combine it with the trapping, you should be able, with the inclusion of the more rules that the trappers want, and in addition to pages, for example, that the MTA does in your book, like on page 53, how to remove a dog from a body gripping trap, things of this nature, because our activities take place at the same time, and we virtually feed off each other, or we work with each other, and we think if this is done, that between those two, you should be able to save some money in the publishing of the book. And this, combined with what Sean and Con have already said, we would like this to be considered. Number five is the rewrite of the commingle law. The rationale for this is it was originally designed for shipments of fur and other animals. Well, as it turns out now, seems that the COs at times have expanded that rule, and they use it more or less as an open search warrant to search sportsmen's freezers based on a hunch. And it becomes a fishing expedition by COs to find wrongdoing for the sportsmen. And we feel that this is this really needs to be rewritten and or clarified, because we get every year there's an issue in a courtroom regarding this issue. We would like that addressed. The other thing that we would like addressed is number six is a rewrite, or at least an intent, or what the intent of the law was for the 3-day check on checking your traps, the body gripping trap, because right now, as it's written, the DNR, in their interpretation of it, you only get 2 days, but yet it's called the three-day rule, and it's not, because if you set your trap on Saturday, you have to check it on Monday. Well, Saturday to Sunday, Sunday to Monday is only 2 days. If it was three, you should be able to check it on Tuesday if it's truly a three-day check. So it's just an interpretation, but we would certainly like to know why do they call it a three-day rule if the intent was to only give you 2 days. So we would like a clarification of this issue.
I can add one thing on foot gripping traps. It's a 1-day check, and that's very good, but the body gripping we want 3 full days, but foot traps are a 1-day, and that's the law, and that's how it should be. Yeah.
That's all I have at the moment. Russ, do you have any?
I'm Russ Nickel. I'm a co-director for District 1. I live in Chisholm, Minnesota. I really wanted just a couple of different issues here. The muskrat issue, I don't think it's been as clear-cut as it sounds. The muskrats, first of all, aren't really what you would call a valuable animal, and they aren't, as the major said, they're in a different category themselves. But if you get caught with a muskrat, you're going to get pinched. If you get caught, turn it into a game warden. I can testify that because I got pinched by for carrying one around one time. So it's really not, I don't think the COs really understand. I think it's a gray area for them. I don't think they really know. And right now, 99% of the muskrats that are being caught in beaver traps are being thrown away, simply because there is not a pelting fee for the muskrats themselves. So why would you bring it in for a $2 muskrat or dollar and a half muskrat? So they are being thrown. That's why we're looking for a concurrent season with the beaver season on the muskrats. Also on the otters themselves, there's a lot of otters being thrown away also in the spring, simply because you can't find a CO because of the area. You're right, because of the 200 road echo trail or whatever it might be, you're not going to get a hold of a CO there, and if he does, it's going to be 2-3 days later, and normally within 3 days they're a fatty animal, they're going to be shot anyway. So there is a pelting fee on the otters already, and we used to have an otter season. I don't know if you the chairperson or committee members know, we had an otter season that ran concurrently with the beaver season for many, many years. It's just been changed probably back in the late 70s or early 80s is when it finally changed back to a separate season. I think, you know, we've talked to John Erb and some of the other DNR people that are the fur bearer specialists, John in particular mentioned that he might be open to such a change if we lowered the limit to be on the safe side, and I think we would think seriously about doing something like that. We haven't seen any opposition from the trappers or the Trappers Association for something like that, just as a test to see if the otter catch is actually going up or down or whatever may happen to it. But those are really the only two issues that I had.
You're saying to lower, have an otter season, but lower the limit?
Possibly. We would like to work with the DNR to see, as a model possibly, to see what might happen.
Representative Cornish. We've heard in this committee over and over and over that everybody's trying to get away from the conservation officers, and now here we got a group that says they're trying to find them. That's kind of interesting. Tell me about the, Representative Cornish, about this co-mingle law business.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's interesting how you're interpreting, because the co-mingled law that I was used to said that if an animal was illegal, any part of the all parts of the shipment were also illegal. I mean, if it was you get a freezer with something dead in it and illegal, that it could be the whole shipment, or the back of a pickup, one dead animal amongst a mother, who would make it the whole thing illegal and subject to seizure. And I don't know if it was instituted because, one illegal, how do they tell if they were all illegal or what the reason for it was, but I guess I'm a little abrasive at the language you used in here about using it for a fishing expedition for further wrongdoing. And there either is wrongdoing, there isn't, and you could have an overzealous, very efficient conservation officer, or you could have, just like in any other discipline of law enforcement, you might have somebody abusing it, but I've never known anybody to use it for a fishing expedition to find something else wrong, unless you got a local problem with some egghead that it isn't getting along with the public or whatever, but I mean, that happens in any profession. So, that's all I could tell you about it. Is I don't know how old the law is. It was there when I was there 20 some years ago, and I hadn't heard of it being abused. I usually hear all the stories, but I haven't heard of anybody using it for fishing expeditions to find something else wrong. What do you mean by that? If you could elaborate a little bit more about you find something illegal, so that makes a whole. What is the officer, he or she, doing from that point once they find the, what's the fishing expedition?
Well, for example, and I don't mean to be flip, but if I'm a trapper and I'm suspected of doing something, so under the commingle rule, they come in and check my freezer, and I have all the furs there, and they're all properly marked and everything, and on furs, I'm very good. Let's say I have too many ducks over the limit, or whether I'm storing them for my relatives or whatever, they not only take my ducks, they take my furs. And this is does not sit well with trappers.
Can I add, it's not necessarily over the limit either. I mean, they can count your fish, they can count your grouse, you know, they're going to count everything, even though it's possibly just fur-related.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm still not following you. I mean, if you need a search warrant to get in somebody's house, usually unless you let them in, and so finding something outside in somebody's truck illegal isn't going to allow you just to walk into their house and check. So I'm wondering how they extend this. I haven't heard of this or that it was a problem. If they're in with a search warrant and they find something illegal in that freezer and it's a wild animal, I can imagine they go through the freezer looking for if there's any other wild animals of the same type illegal. But I'm trying to figure out how they would extend this circumstance to your disadvantage, to either legal or illegal. And I guess I've never heard of this commingled goods problem.
For the sake of time, I guess, could I chat with you after the meeting?
Sure.
And I will. I'll bring you a case that isn't necessarily popular amongst, including the trappers, and I'll explain some issues.
Well, Mr. Representative Dillon and I have run across a number of cases that weren't set well with trappers or hunters, either one, but we try to, if we can, to deal them with them separate things instead of changing the whole thing, except in a few cases.
Does anyone from the public want to testify regarding this, other than the folks who have ever testified? Any members of the committee have any further questions of any of the testifiers? Representative Carney.
I do sympathize with them as that split season opener, though, because when I lived up north, if you got bad weather, a quick freeze up, sometimes you didn't have any time to trap.
That's true.
With opening dates. And I wish they could settle that somehow and not worry so much if the fur was prime or if it wasn't prime. If it's not prime, they're not going to get a good price for it, or they're not even going to buy it. And somehow to set that, to give these folks an advantage, because trapping is a part of our history. I mean, how we've explored the state, and it's very important to do. And so I just wish we could give these guys some kind of break or come to some solution on that split season.
Representative Tal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I might have a solution. We just allow folks, these good folks, to trap whenever they want, whatever they want, and then I think that'll solve the problem.
All right. Is that how they did it in Laos?
Yes, July 1st.
Okay, so one of the questions I had is you've been very adamant about having your own book of regulations. That sounds like about a $5 per person operation. Having not heard from Mr. Bogus, but just throwing a number out there, that's about $5 for every trapping license, $30,000 to print the book, and maybe I'm low. Trapping Association willing to go on record and support that and pay for it and license fee increase?
Well, right now, the small game license is, what is it, $19 or $15. The trapping license is $19. So we pay over $35, $36 already.
That wasn't my question.
I know.
we could not address that today because we would have to bring it back to the association and bring it up to the membership.
Mr. Bogus, could you come up and Mr. Smith? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. It would be interesting to get a fiscal note on that because the DNR spends a lot of money on that, and they sold advertisement, those color pages, in order to get some of that money back. And it's kind of interesting to see how much it costs per page. Because they put out, what is it, 100,000 of these things statewide, all the you distribute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, we print about 800,000 of these books.
So each page is...
Representative McNamara, I'm sorry. Did you have a question for any of the testifiers? We'll have them come back up.
Well, and truthfully, Mr. Bogus may be able to answer it too, but a lot of the talk centered around the incidental take. And I'm assuming it looks like the only thing you're really supposed to trap in the spring is beaver, and then they have incidental take. And the two species I heard the most of was the otter and the rats. I guess I'm wondering, does the DNR, what would be so serious if we allowed the incidental taking of rats when they're beaver trapping? I mean, that wouldn't mean you'd be going into muskrat houses and putting out traps, but if they were clearly in beaver runs and such. And then also, if there's a limit on the otter, is this limit a 2 and 4? Is that the whole season long? So I'm assuming, is it possible that we could allow some incidental taking of otter in the spring?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, we're having some discussions on that. The beaver season is very long right now because we tried to maximize the season as long as we could because of the issues that beaver caused with flooding and things like that. An incidental take of otter, they are captured in the same types of sets that are set for beaver. Muskrats, it is more of an incidental thing that, if we were going to allow incidental muskrats to be kept, we'd probably want to put a rule in that you couldn't set small muskrat-sized traps during the beaver season because they aren't going to hold a beaver anyway. And we also might want to look at ratcheting the beaver season back a little bit so it doesn't go into the middle of May when otters are having young and things like that. And people can still trap beavers by permit and things like that when they're causing damage. So we're discussing some of those potential options.
Anyone else? Okay, my question is when can we expect as this committee to have some expectation that you're going to get through some of this so that if you don't get through it, we can help you get through it? And you know,
Mr. Chair,
it doesn't turn up like you'd like it to be.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is there's a meeting to discuss a number of these things already scheduled for March 6th. I would think that sometime shortly after that, we could give you a progress report.
First deadline is March the 12th. Better move the meeting up.
We'll see what we can do, Mr. Chair.
Some of these items are going to get addressed. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to weigh in while so many of the trappers are here. I myself don't know if I like the idea of a separate synopsis for trapping, and I guess I'd like to ask Mr. Vargas if I could. I like the idea of some of that being available to the hunting community, that information and such, especially if maybe they're thinking about trapping and they might be reading about it when they're bored in the duck blind or whatever. But when we have questions, I guess this is a bigger question. I've often wondered, the big book of regulations, is there ever a big book, or are people subjected to go to the statutes to figure out the rest of it, or is there a big book that people can buy that have the rest of what the COs know about?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, enforcement publishes two booklets for the officers that are the statutes verbatim and the rules verbatim. This book attempts to combine those in a more readable format. Obviously, they don't have all of the exact language of the statutes and the rules. Those two volumes are about this size. You don't have one with you, but they're a couple inches thick, spiral bound volumes that are the verbatim statutes and the verbatim rules. I think what we would propose to do would at least be to expand the trapping section of this. We'll also talk about a separate booklet, but there's so much duplication in terms of, like I said, public lands, general rules, trespass laws, and things like that, that it gets to be pretty redundant to every time you do a new book. But we'll look at both options, and if there are some things that are missing in here that have been an issue, we'll add them in.
De McNamara.
Is that is this the big book you referred to with the spiral bind or whatever? Is that available to the public to buy, or is that just an internal document?
Mr. Chair, Major Smith is saying it's internal. We don't print a supply for sale.
Any other questions for Mr. Bogus? Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the guys from the Trappers Association. And anyone else have anything from the committee? Okay, meeting is adjourned.